Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and if you're listening to this, that means that you've pledged to support the Monster Man podcast at the $2 level or higher, so thank you very much. Over the last couple of episodes, we've been talking about Sumerian mythology. We started out introducing the various gods, and last episode, we added a god that I felt was overlooked from her presentation here in the AD&D Deities and Demigods book, and that was Ereshkigal, the Queen of the Underworld. Now, there's one more deity from Sumerian and later Mesopotamian mythology who I thought could also be pretty useful in a game of Dungeons & Dragons, so that's who we're going to start out talking about today, and that's Ninurta. And then after Ninurta, we're going to talk a little bit of, you know, kind of a recap overview of all of... We're going to do kind of a recap overview of the whole mythology, and we're going to talk a little bit about cloud chariots. As you can maybe tell by listening to me, I've got a little bit of a cold at the moment, so if my voice is kind of hoarse, that's why. I apologize. Okay, let's talk about Ninurta. Now, Ninurta is a Sumerian god who is kind of Enlil's go-get-stuff-done guy. Ninurta is the son of Enlil and Ninlil, and in fact, he is the grandfather of the legendary hero Gilgamesh. Now, like a lot of Mesopotamian deities, Ninurta went through a number of changes before he came to the form that we're going to recognize him in. We're not going to go into too much detail about those. He may have just been kind of a local god or an agrarian god who gradually achieved more prominence in Mesopotamian religion until he came to be thought of as kind of this divine champion. And he may be associated... And he may have been a patron deity of Lagash. The main reason that I say that Ninurta would be an interesting god to have in a D&D game is that he's a very active god who goes out and gets in fights and sort of does the bidding of Enlil. And I think, therefore, he's kind of a good model for adventuring clerics or even paladins. You know, he'd be a good deity for a paladin because he has this ethos of going out and fighting demons. You know, he's not as sort of like tricky or ambiguous as someone like Enki or Inanna, you know. And if you want the sort of the Sumerian, the closest thing the Sumerian pantheon has to your goody two shoes, you know, put a boot in a demon's face, St. Cuthbert kind of character, that would be Ninurta. Now, there are several different texts that discuss the exploits of Ninurta, and probably the most famous of those is the one that's often just called The Exploits of Ninurta. It's called the Lugal A, which means, which is, like a lot of texts, it's named after its first words, so that just means, O King, and it's, you know, Ninurta is the king being addressed at the beginning of the story. And interesting, again, to see that the king is a Lugal, like we've talked about in the past. So maybe it's, you know, Ninurta and his ilk, this kind of subsequent generation of gods, who are more allied with the Lugal, rather than the En being supported by older gods like Enlil or Enki. That'd be a fun idea. And certainly, Ninurta seems like a very kind of subordinate god, and he's sort of a hero, almost, who just happens to have divine powers. But that's not to say he doesn't mean business. Ninurta is a bad mamma jamma. Let's take a look at what he's got. Okay, so here's the intro of Ninurta from the Lugale. O king, storm of majestic splendor, peerless Ninurta, possessing superior strength, who pillages the mountains all alone, deluge, indefatigable serpent, hurling yourself at the rebel land, hero striding formidably into battle, lord whose powerful arm is fit to bear the mace, reaping like barley the necks of the insubordinate. Ninurta, king, son in whose strength his father rejoices, hero whose awesomeness covers the mountains like a south storm, Ninurta, who makes the good tiara, the rainbow, flash like lightning, grandly begotten by him who wears the princely beard, dragon who turns on himself, strength of a lion snarling at a snake, roaring hurricane, Ninurta, king, whom Enlil has exalted above himself, hero, great battle net flung over the foe, Ninurta, with the awesomeness of your shadow extending over the land, releasing fury on the rebel lands, overwhelming their assemblies, Ninurta, king, son who has forced homage to his father far and wide. Yeah, all right, steady on, anonymous Sumerian language poet. But this gives you kind of the impression, you know, there's none of your subtle, is this a good guy or not stuff that we had with Inanna, or, you know, Enki, you're confusing the speech in people's mouths, is that a good thing or a bad thing? No, Ninurta finds out that demons are up to some business, and he goes and he smacks them in the mug with his mace. And what a mace it is! Ninurta is armed with Shar-Ur, a magical mace whose name means, and I am not making this up, Smasher of Thousands. That is a satisfying magical mace. Yeah, Ninurta is pretty impressively tooled up, because not only is Shar-Ur good for reaping like barley the necks of the rebels, but actually it has all kinds of stuff. It's intelligent. He talks to it, and it sort of records his deeds, and it communicates with Enlil for him. So already we can see our clerics or paladins of Ninurta, you know, getting ready to go bust some people up with their maces, which are in fact sacred to Ninurta. I mean, they would have been kind of the standard, you know, weapon of the era. Like, maces are a symbol of royal authority in general, and maces would have been pretty common. But, you know, whatever. The Shar-Ur, the Smasher of Thousands. You know, it's the mace of all maces. In this particular story, Ninurta has to go deal with a demon, question mark? A supernatural being of some kind called Asag. And again, I'm probably pronouncing this all wrong. But Asag and a bunch of stones have gone into rebellion against the natural order. And, Ninurta goes off and sorts them out. And then he takes each of the stones and he assigns them to, like, their proper place. So, you will be carved into ritual vessels and you will be carved into whatever, right? So it sort of ends in a just-so story. But interesting that Asag has taken these stones, apparently kind of elemental beings, to be his allies. So that'd be kind of a fun enemy to have in a D&D scenario, that the earth elementals, the stones, are actually just upset at their uses in society. If you've ever played the miniatures war game Hordes of the Things, and if you haven't, I recommend giving it a read. It's a very versatile, if not always necessarily easy to understand, rule system, and it had in the back this tremendous appendix of army lists from different fantasy series, different historical periods, from different, you know, films, and from mythologies all around the world. There was an army list for the Ramayana, there was an army list, you know, for Greek myth, there was an army list for Norse myth, and there was one for Asag and the Stone Allies. And the idea was that you wouldn't even use miniatures for them, you would just, I mean, you'd make Asag, and then everything else would just be rocks from your garden. Although, if you wanted to use the particular kinds of stones commanded by Asag here, it'd be a little more complex than that. So that is a Sumerian text, the Lugal A. And then there's also another one of these, which is called Ninurta's Return to Nippur. So basically, it's just a praise. And in it, they talk about Ninurta, you know, having successfully defeated the enemy, he comes home to Nippur. Just a few more words about the Shar-Ur. Sometimes it's called Shar-Ur, sometimes it's called the Shar-Ur. I guess that's just a translation question. But yeah, so here we go. So here are, this is from the Lugal A, I think, lines 251 to 264. In his battle, he smote the mountains with a cudgel. The Shar-Ur made the storm wind rise to heaven, scattering the people. Its spittle alone destroyed the townspeople. The destructive mace set fire to the mountains. The murderous weapon smashed skulls with its painful teeth. The club, which tears out entrails, piled up noses. The lance was stuck into the ground, and the crevasses filled with blood in the rebel lands. Dogs licked it up like milk. The enemy rose up, crying to wife and child, "You did not lift your arms in prayer to Lord Ninurta." The weapon covered the mountains with dust, but did not shake the heart of Asag. The Shar-Ur threw its arms around the neck of the Lord. So the Shar-Ur has a face and teeth and arms. So here, I mean, I guess it's an animate mace. I like the idea that it's a head with, like, a sharp, biting mouth. Some pretty great imagery there. In another myth, remember I said that Enlil once had the Tablets of Destiny swiped off him while he was in the bath? And, of course, who had to go and get them back but Ninurta, because that's the kind of thing Ninurta does in this pantheon, is someone loses the Tablets of Destiny, and Ninurta has to go and get them back. And so this is pretty great. The culprit here is something called Anzu, which is like a bird creature. And Ninurta, this text is in Akkadian, not Sumerian. But I'm going to include it anyway. And Ninurta has to go fight Anzu, and he shoots an arrow at Anzu, but because Anzu has the Tablet of Destiny, or the Tablets of Destiny, he's able to take the arrow apart. And so here we are. He drew the bow and knocked an arrow. He drew the bow, he launched an arrow. The arrow did not approach Anzu, but returned. Anzu called out to it, "Arrow that has come, return to your reed bed. Frame of the bow, return to your forest. Bowstring to the ram's tendon, arrow flight to the birds." Carrying the Tablet of Destinies of the gods in his hand, the bowstring of the bow launched an arrow, but it did not approach his body. The clash of weapons ceased in the midst of the mountain. Anzu was not conquered. And so then Ninurta actually summons up Sharur. He says he called Sharur and issued a command to him. Repeat the deeds that you saw to Ea and Nishiku. Now, Ea is the is another name for our old pal Enki. So he is actually sending Sharur off to report back on how the battle is going. And then off he flies, or off he goes to go see them. And then Nishiku says, Nishiku heard the word of his son. Here, apparently this Nish... I mean, maybe Nishiku is another name for Enlil, I'm not sure. Called Sharur and should command to him, repeat to your lord the word of the utterance of my mouth and heed all that I say for him. And then he basically gives him, you know, the tips that he needs to defeat Anzu. So Sharur is actually, you know, flying around communicating between Ninurta and the other gods. Okay, so Ninurta, I think, is a terrific deity to have in your pantheon. He's basically your go-out-there-and-get-stuff-done hero deity. He's got a sweet magic mace. He fights demons. He restores the natural order. He's lawful good, straight up, or at least lawful neutral. And I think he's a lot of fun. Now, the question is, why is he not included in this pantheon the way that it's written? Now, partly, sort of what's happened is that his attributes have been rolled into Enlil. In the stories in which Ninurta appears, Enlil is much more like the guy back at Ops, you know? Enlil and Enki or Ea, they're just sort of giving advice and telling Ninurta to go do things. They're the people who set strategy, and Ninurta's the guy who goes and executes. So maybe it was felt that, you know, they combined that role into Enlil and made him a more heroic figure. You know, the Enlil running around bashing things with his stone axe, which is maybe, you know, like the Sharur, doesn't leave a lot of room for Ninurta to play essentially the same role. It's also because, if you remember all the way back to the first time we talked about Sumerian mythology, which was like 2 episodes ago, admittedly, there's a note at the beginning of this section that says that they've exaggerated the differences between Sumerian and Babylonian mythology in order to make them, you know, in order to make it worthwhile to have two of them, so that they're not just basically the same as each other, because there are a lot of similarities in real life. And one of those similarities is kind of Ninurta. I mean, if you think about it, he's basically just Marduk. You know, once again, we have a high ruling god, and then a go-get-stuff-done kind of divine prince who goes and puts the boot in on demons for a more remote and detached father deity. And if we wanted to, although I'm not saying we should, we can see a kind of succession of these deities, right? With An siring Enlil, and then Enlil siring Ninurta. Anyway, Ninurta, he's pretty great. You definitely want him to play the role that he's the patron deity of your sort of like brash, take-no-nonsense paladins, whether those are the kinds of guys that you want to have your player characters playing, or whether they're the kind of like by-the-book, stick up the backside, you know, hard-charging tough guys that your wily clerics of Enki and Inanna have to sort of trick their way around in order to get things done without these stiffs noticing. And actually, that'd be a pretty fun concept. Anyway, so that's Ninurta. Great magical mace, loves to fight demons, basically Enlil's hit guy. I think if you're likely to wind up fighting a member of the Sumerian pantheon, it could be Inanna. There's a line in here that calls battle the Dance of Inanna. So it could be Inanna, or alternatively, it's likely to be Ninurta, right? If Enlil decides that you're messing up, the chances are good that he's going to send Ninurta to sort you out, give you a little bit of the old Sharur. In which case, good luck to you. Okay, so that's my last deity that I wanted to include in the Sumerian pantheon. So let's talk about a few other aspects of including Sumerian religion in your Dungeons & Dragons games. First thing that I didn't mention from the Sumerian section is the cloud chariots. So right at the very end, after the entry on Utu the sun god, there's a brief note about cloud chariots. All of the gods and goddesses have cloud chariots at their personal command. These devices appear to be clouds that give off a dazzling radiance. When a god steps on them, they become platforms of transportation for the gods, and also a means to impress worshippers and non-believers alike. A cloud chariot travels at a rate of yada yada yada. It's unaffected by any material force and it's never destroyed. The gods will always appear to their clerics on such devices to prove that they are gods. And there is an image, indeed, of a god stepping down off of a cloud chariot and a bunch of people in, you know, in front of some thatch-roofed cottages, you know, kneeling down and prostrating themselves before the Shining Deity. And considering all the stuff that gods can already do, I don't know why having a cloud chariot necessarily proves that you're a god. It's interesting that they're referred to as devices, too. I think you could come up with a very interesting Dungeons & Dragons cosmology in which the gods weren't necessarily gods in the sense of cosmic forces, but much more kind of like think about the role that quote-unquote gods play in Marvel Comics. Perhaps to avoid offending the, you know, monotheistic sensibilities of most of their readers, or perhaps to avoid committing to any kind of position on the divine, Marvel continuity has never really been 100% consistent about what it means that characters like Thor or Hercules are gods. Sometimes they appear to be very much gods in the mythological sense. Sometimes they seem to be merely very powerful members of some kind of unspecified alien race worshipped as gods by humans. The latter is very much the position taken by the Marvel movies, and in the comics it kind of goes back and forth a little bit. But I do like the idea that the Cloud Chariot is a device, perhaps a device beyond the comprehension of people from a Dungeons & Dragons universe. And these ultra-terrestrials capable of manipulating the universe are just kind of putting themselves off as gods, because that's the way that people from these primitive cultures would understand them. But on the other hand, since they apparently created these cultures, who knows? Okay. So, let's say we've decided to incorporate Sumerian religion into our Dungeons & Dragons game. What are the pros and cons? Well, first things first, this is a religion where dungeons actually play a really important role. You know, we have these ziggurats, these sacred sites, which are often believed to connect directly to the underworld. We talked before about the Ekur, the mountain house, the sacred temple of Enlil, being the tethering post of the world, the thing that connects the earth to heaven, and possibly also to the underworld, because Kur is also the underworld. So we have a premise for a really interesting, maybe even a mecha dungeon, this idea that the underworld is a physical place that you can go to if you can find the right entrance, and that if you go all the way down, you might find yourself in another plane of existence. So that'd be kind of interesting. We also have this society where, even if you yourself are not a cleric or a paladin, religion and the gods play a really important role in everyday life, and I don't mean just in terms of sort of ordinary acts of piety, but even in terms of the politics and government of these city-states. And this works really well because when you think about Sumerian society, you think even if there is some kind of unifying dynasty or empire, we're talking about a lot of different, more or less separate autonomous city-states, at least for most of its history. And what that means is because these states are relatively small and relatively close together, you can have a bunch of them in your Dungeons & Dragons campaign. So you could have one city that's devoted to Enlil, and one that's devoted to Enki, and one that's devoted to Inanna, and you could actually have the characters plausibly traveling between them in a short space of time, which would give you the opportunity to explore the contrast between cities ruled by the priesthoods of those gods, or indeed, ruled directly by those gods. So if you wanted to get some clerical politics going on, we could definitely get that in this pantheon in a way that might be a little more challenging in, like, say, Norse mythology. We can certainly see that different gods might have different agendas, and that the political and material power of their temples might be a matter of interest to them. This seems to be a pantheon of deities who live quite close to their worshippers, which is good for our purposes, certainly. In a game where you've got something like cleric domains, we can see that we have definitely got deities that fit most of them, so that's nice. We have kind of like, it's sort of an earthy nature-focused pantheon. We've got Ki, who's there to support druids. We've got Ninhursag, who's kind of your typical, you know, earth mothery type, although with gravity powers and stuff that maybe we don't typically associate with earth mother goddesses. Even Ninhursag doesn't quite fit the bill of a generally, you know, nicey-nice, let's-heal-everybody-neutral-good type of a character, though. It's sort of an interesting thing that's not present in this or many other historical pantheons, despite the fact that it's a pretty common role for clerics in the game. So that's a fun one. And if you ever want, you know, your basic humorless paladin with a longsword, okay, he wouldn't have a longsword in this, he would have a mace, because that's going to be Ninurta. And Erish Kigal could make a fun antagonist, as we've seen from the story of Inanna's descent into the underworld. Erish Kigal's not necessarily a baddie. She has her own agenda, and she's very bound by the rules of hell, but I don't know that that necessarily makes her a villain, although she could certainly be an opponent. In fact, did I say this already? In fact, the end of Inanna's descent into the underworld actually says, O Ereshkigal, great is thy praise, which is not necessarily what you'd expect, although it's a phrase that we're going to see as we go through Sumerian and other Mesopotamian mythology. O so-and-so, great is thy praise, comes up. But I feel like we got a couple of real good value gods in here. You know, Enlil, I mean, I don't want to hate on Enlil. He is basically your sky god, king of the gods. You know, if you were thinking about how to use Enlil, and most of the time you just kind of thought, well, how would Zeus act? You're probably right. Although there's not so much of the same lecherousness, or there is, but the mythology is less in line with cultural norms of a culture we feel familiar with. I don't know if that makes any sense. My point is, I don't think that Enlil is a lecherous character. I think that the Sumerian myths are meant to be less like things that happen in human society. Honestly, if you want to portray Enlil, 4 times out of 5, you just kind of want to be thinking, God. What is he? He's God. He acts like God. But Enki and Inanna, they are pretty good value for money. You know, Enki is tricky and weird. He might frequently ask his clerics to do things that don't obviously make any sense. Inanna has that great, very personal relationship with people she likes. We're going to see that crop up again when we get into Babylonian mythology in her guise as Ishtar. And that's really a great way to make your cleric's relationship with the deity seem vital, you know? The idea that Inanna might see high-ranking clerics of her faith as lovers, or not even lovers, but like her favorites, people that she has a little bit of a crush on, and she kind of bends the rules to protect them. But at the same time, someone whose disfavor it might be dangerous to earn. And we can certainly imagine that Inanna might be jealous. So, tricky, duplicitous, not 100% good, powerful gods, under a pretty much by the book, but kind of high level, not always directly involved, king of the gods. That sounds like a recipe for fun divine adventures. And if you get the chance, I think it's worth reading up on some of these Sumerian myths. I'm going to put some links in the show notes that'll take you to translations of some of these texts. When we get to Babylonian mythology, the Epic of Gilgamesh is, you know, available in a Penguin edition. That's the one I have. I also have this N.K. Sanders Penguin Poems of Heaven and Hell from Ancient Mesopotamia. Now, this mixes together, you know, Sumerian and Babylonian and I think Assyrian and whatever texts in there. But for the purposes of a role-playing game, we're not really concerned about limiting ourselves to just one era. I will say that no matter what the authors of Deities and Demigods have done, I probably don't want to have a campaign that involves both Babylonian and Sumerian mythology. They are still pretty similar to each other. You might get away with kind of combining them, or alternatively, setting up kind of an old gods, new gods conflict with, you know, in Babylonian mythology, with Enlil starting to take a back seat to Marduk, and Enlil maybe not being too happy about that. So we might have multiple versions of the same pantheon. So that could be fun. But I don't know that I would have, you know, both a cleric of Enki and a cleric of Ea. You know, they seem quite similar to each other. Although we'll see, they're not necessarily exactly the same when we get to Babylonian mythology. However, that's not going to be our next stop. Having covered Sumerian mythology, I want to get into one that I know a little bit better and one that, you know, has a little bit of marquee value, one we're probably going to spend quite a lot of time, more than just about 4 episodes. So I'm going to put up a poll asking you guys what you think should be the next pantheon that we cover here on Patron Deities. So vote in that. And then I'm going to leave it open for 1 week, and at the end of that week, I'm going to record the first episode on the winner. And that's going to be either Greek mythology or Norse mythology, either of which I think would be like a fun core pantheon that you could use in a lot of different campaigns, and both of which I think are going to be a little bit different than we might necessarily expect. Okay. So once you've listened to this episode, don't forget to go ahead and vote in the poll. It'll be in the update stream on Patreon, so you should be able to just go to patreon.com/monsterman and vote there. Once again, thank you all for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. Cannot express how much I appreciate it. So thank you for supporting Monster Man, and thank you for listening to Patron Deities. Don't forget to vote in the poll,
and I'll see you next time.